I've very much been looking forward to this session. We've got a great panel, I think, put together to hopefully meet your information and resource needs. I'll introduce all of our panellists straight up, I think, and then we will hear from each of the panellists for around about 10 minutes, and then we're going to leave the remainder of the session open to you for your questions, because question time is really, really an important part of these forums. So our panel consists of, and starting from, actually, they're not in order of speaking, so our first speaker will be Kylie McCutcheon, and Kylie is an NDIS participant who has gone through the application process, the planning process, the internal review process, the external review process, right up to an appeal at the Administrative Appeals Tribunal. So she's going to take us through her experience. And then James Keith, who is an advocate from Geelong, who works for REAC, which is Rights Information and Advocacy Centre. He is also an external merits review support person, and he'll speak about the support that he offered to Kylie when she first made contact with REAC. And, of course, he'll take us through the external merits review process. Then we'll hear from Len Jaffet, who is the Manager Commonwealth Entitlements Civil Justice at Victoria Legal Aid. And he's going to talk to us about the process when an appeal is being made and an external merits review support person or an advocate or a person with a disability has gone through the NDIA internal review process, and now they're seeking to get some funding for legal aid support if their case has escalated to the Administrative Appeals Tribunal. And then we'll finish by hearing from Rosalinda Casamento, and she is a senior lawyer with Victoria Legal Aid. So I think we're in for a great treat this afternoon. Tony Van Hammond earlier set this panel up nicely, I think. She gave us a bit of an appreciation of a very rough sketch of the complaint and appeal and review process that occurs within NDIA. And so I'm hoping that the next hour or so is going to expand on that a little bit more and help all of us here to have a greater appreciation of the steps that are involved. Now, before I hand over to Kylie, what we have done, you will find during the lunch break that Natasha has placed on your tables 4 copies only per table, but everybody who has registered for this forum will get copies made available to you via email, via a link to the resource page on the DIRA website. But we've drafted a little bit of a flow chart to aid in this next session, to aid in your understanding of the steps that a person with a disability or a person affected by a decision made by the NDIA will go through if they're going from applying to be an NDIS participant right through the appeals and reviews process and complaints process that ultimately leads to a hearing at the Administrative Appeals Tribunal. We've deliberately tried to keep it as a flowchart or a step-by-step document rather than a process document with every single step explained, just to aid in your understanding. So I hope, as a result, it has draft written all over it, and we will make special attention to discussions that occur out of this session to finalise that draft and make that document available as a resource for you and anybody else who you care about. So without further ado, let's hand the microphone over to Kylie McCutcheon. And Kylie, I'll proceed. I'll start by just asking you the question, what happened?
So my name's Kylie. I'm 38 years old and I live on the Bellarine Peninsula with my 8-year-old daughter and 2 cats and 2 rabbits at this stage. I have been blessed with a number of disabilities and medical conditions. I was born with spina bifida and scoliosis, and I developed a disease in my left hip as a child called Perthes disease, which essentially eats away the femoral head and you get a square peg in a round hole, and doesn't particularly work well. So I currently have kidney failure and I do nocturnal dialysis at home 4 to 5 nights a week. I have worked in many different areas over my life, one of them being in the office of a disability advocacy organisation, which gave me the great privileges to hear a lot of stories from a lot of people with different disabilities, and hopefully I could help to improve their quality of life. For me, I had an individual support package under the Victorian State Government, which provided for some home care, garden maintenance, and the physical therapies I needed to keep my body mobile and moving as best as possible. Like all people who were going to be affected by the changes of NDIA, I followed the advertising that was in the media and was fairly confident that not much would change for me, as there was no loss of service agreement with the state government. Therefore, in the advertising's words, no one would be worse off under the NDIA. Unfortunately, simple or easy was not how it would turn out to be. I was asked to attend a planning meeting which would turn out to be quite a chaotic experience. At that point, planning meetings were held in the CRS building in Geelong while NDIA were constructing their building. To this day, I couldn't tell you whether I met with a CRS planner or an NDIA planner. But anyway, I pulled out this document that was my ISP and I kind of said to them, well, this is working really well in my life. Like, I'd like this to be refunded again under NDIA. Well, apparently they actually had never seen an ISP before, and I was told that it's really not that simple. Apparently there's this large workbook that you're supposed to that I was supposed to have received and filled in before this meeting. Anyhow, we worked through this workbook and off I went on my merry way. About four to six weeks later, I received a letter with an appointment to come to the new NDIA offices for a plan meeting. At this meeting, I was presented with this document called My Plan, and all the funding that I had previously had for physical therapies had I had to maintain my mobility had been taken out of this plan, and I was told point blank, we don't fund physical therapies, and if you want to keep having them, you're going to have to fund them yourself. At that point, I was probably in shock, and I went home and read all the paperwork they had given me and found that I could request an internal review, which I did. That came back upholding the original decision, for the reasons being that the request I was making, what in their opinion didn't meet the reasonable and necessary legislation or the effective and beneficial legislation. At that point, I was very sick. I had whooping cough and pneumonia and wasn't coping well at all, and therefore just accepted the decision with a lot of moaning and grumbling, I think. As the months went by and my savings ran out, my mobility rapidly deteriorated, and I went from walking with a limp mostly to relying on my wheelchair because my muscles and joints were seizing up. Having a scoliosis, my spine curves slightly to the left, therefore the muscles in the left side of my body contract down, and in the right side they stretch up the other way, which causes great pain when left to its own devices to pull my body around in strange directions. So as a consequence, I had to quit my job because I physically couldn't do it anymore, and at that point I was studying early childhood and development because I wanted to become a kindergarten teacher, which has also had to be put on hold because doing a 0-2 placement probably won't work so well in a wheelchair. So that, I suppose, is what the immediate impact of one decision is on one person's life. At that point, I was quite distressed by the consequences of this particular plan, and the task of negotiating the next plan had arrived. Feelings of dread flooded my mind and my body, and I needed help. I did a Google search for disability advocacy in Geelong and found Rights Advocacy and Information Centre. I phoned them and James answered the call. That same afternoon, James came to see me at home to help me get a plan of what to do. Relief would be the word of that moment. Someone understood what I needed. James attended the plan review with me and along with Lance helped me with the paperwork for what is called a review of a reviewable decision, which is supposed to be a plain English document. To try to have physical therapies included in my new plan. The original review outcome was upheld and my only options were to apply to the AAT for an external review or accept the decision. I chose to apply to the AAT for an external review and went on a long, quite stressful and sometimes scary journey because I simply couldn't function in my life as it was and I really had nothing left to lose. An external review consists of three parts: a directions type hearing that establishes what the disagreement is about and each side's opinion. Then there is a conciliation hearing that aims to find a mutually acceptable solution, and finally a hearing where a judge makes a decision. My case went to a hearing, which I won, and the judge agreed that chiropractic was a reasonable and necessary support for me and that it would be beneficial for me to function in my life. My case was the first case where lived experience was taken into account in determining the outcome of the case, in which is important for people with disabilities as there often hasn't been research that is relevant to your situation that can be relied upon to determine whether a therapy is helpful or not. On the day, I was confronted with three NDIA lawyers and two staff, which was a very intimidating situation given we were in a small boardroom at Deakin Waterfront. I had fortunately been able to apply for legal aid funding as my case was considered novel and complex and therefore was given a legal aid lawyer to help me navigate a complex system along with James and Lance. Without the support of these people, I would never have been able to navigate such a complex system alone. I believe that advocacy is imperative when dealing with NDIA at the planning stage and from raising a complaint through to an AAT review. I initially didn't expect to be confronted in such a way when NDIA was in its initial stages, but with all the inadequate and misinformation given to me along the way, I needed someone who had the knowledge of the system and how to navigate the system to get the supports I needed. Sorry, gone blank. That'll do.
Thanks, Kylie. I was just thinking whether or not I prompt you, but yeah, I think that's a nice natural break, and we can now move on to James. And James from REAC, if you could take us through the process once Kylie made contact with you.
Afternoon. Thanks for inviting us. It's really good to be here, and hopefully we can give a bit of an insight as to what's been going on in the Barwon region. With Kylie, she, I think, was really brave to ask for help and assistance, which was really quite important, I think, so that we could challenge the decisions of the NDIA. I would certainly say that advocacy is really paramount and that the funding is still put forward for that. Because some people, they need that help, they need that assistance, they need that voice if they don't have a voice, and obviously they need that person to be there, just to be there, so that they can have the confidence to have that conversation the difference I've seen in many clients that I've supported, because they've had somebody beside them who's on their side, gives them that hope, that possibility that they can have that conversation to try and make changes in their life for themselves. And ultimately, if that person can't do that, then as an advocate, we're more than happy to help facilitate that for them. So with the NDIA rolling into Geelong, as Tony has already said, it's a new thing for everybody. So everybody's learning. The opportunities to challenge the NDIA, their decisions, I think has been really good within the Barwon region. To date, we've had, I think, over 20 cases gone forward to the Administrative Appeal Tribunal. And I think we've won most of them. I think we've only lost two. I'm not sure. Maybe Len will tell me. I'm not sure. It's really important to challenge. When you're going through that planning process and you feel that something isn't quite right within your plan, then have that conversation with the planner and tell them, I'm not happy with it. I would sometimes always say, if you can put it in writing, please put it in writing, because there's a lot of things that are not transferred through verbal communication. And if it's put in writing, then at the very last stage, where we've gone through all the different reviews within the NDIA, there's what's called the T documents. It's the tribunal documents. And that's basically everything to do with that person within the NDIA on the specifics of the supports that they've requested. So if you've asked for something and it's in an email and the NDIA haven't acted on it, or it's gone missing, it's really good for that reason, because we've got that paper trail. So if you can back everything up by email or letters, that would be really a good thing to try and do. Having that conversation with the planner, you might get changes to your plan, which is fantastic. They may say, yeah, okay, we could maybe make that happen. The planner will go away and get that verified from a delegate, generally would be an assistant director, and hopefully we're all good. But the way we've gone through the processes within the NDIA, sometimes that doesn't happen. So we'll have to go through what's called a review. So you can ask for a review of your plan, and Tony touched on that. And if you go through that process, then we get the result, it's great. But if you don't get the result at that review, as Kylie said, we have to go for what's called a review of a reviewable decision. Long, winding, but the gist of that is we ask for a review on the supports for Kylie because we feel that the NDIA should pay for them. The NDIA then give that to somebody on another team who were not part of the original decision. They review what Kylie's asked for. These supports need to be in my plan. Please reconsider. And that delegate will go away and they'll look at that reasonable and necessary that Tony told us about. Is it value for money? They'll look at that as well. So there's lots of things they'll look at within that review. And they'll come back with a decision. And they'll either uphold the decision or they'll make changes to that decision. And if they make the changes, then that's fantastic. That review has worked at that point in that process for that individual. If they uphold the original decision, which was in Kylie's case, then Kylie clearly is going to be disadvantaged. So we have to look at that next process. So we would get a letter from the delegate to say, I've reviewed your request. And they will quote the legislation on whichever part of the legislation the supports fall under. So you'll get this letter and it'll say subsection 3, paragraph 2, you know, whatever it is. And we have to go find that to make sure what they're actually talking about fits within the legislation. at that point, it can be quite traumatic for that individual. As Kylie's already said that, there are many people who look at that letter and they just put it in the bin. Or it just gathers dust. And there is a process that you have to go through to follow that appeal. And from the date of that review from the delegate, then you should have 28 days to appeal that. Many people do not appeal within 28 days because they're upset. They might not have the supports. They're angry. They're anxious. So that's taken into account through the Administrative Appeal Tribunal process, because we can put forward an extension for the delay, and we'll have to give good reason for that. And if the Administrative Appeal Tribunal say, yeah, okay, we support that, then we can go forward with that appeal process. Just now, REACRS, we're funded for that external merits review support in the Barwon region. And it takes us down to Colac and everywhere within that area. And it's been really quite challenging for us to go through that process. But we are there to help with the paperwork, to help put forward all the applications, make sure it's completed, make sure you've got all the letters. And then we email that to the Administrative Appeal Tribunal. They'll come back with an automated email saying, thanks very much, we've received it. And then within 3 days, the Administrative Appeal Tribunal will make contact with that person or that person's representative. So it may be a child, but they'll make contact with that family member. And then that process starts, as Kylie said. We have that teleconference, so that they'll set a date for that teleconference, that initial conversation. Is this what you're challenging? These supports are not adequate. So the participant will say, yes, that's what we're challenging. If we've got a lawyer, then they will put forward a case for that as well. And the NDIA will say, yeah, we understand, that's why we're here. So they put that forward so that we understand why are we going to the Administrative Appeal Tribunal. So that everybody understands what would be the next process. And sometimes NDAs came back and said, we're more than happy to have a chat. Let's set a time after this, because we might have some wiggle room to try and make changes to our original decision. So that's great if that happens. The second part to that is conciliation. So the date will be set probably 3 weeks for that conciliation, and that will be facilitated by the Administrative Appeal Tribunal member. If we've got the funding for a lawyer, and Len's going to explain that process for the CAPS funding, then the lawyer will be present through that conversation, the support person from REAC, the individual, and then the NDIA will be there. They'll have maybe 1, 2, 3 lawyers, just depends. They might have the director of the site, some assistant director. So there could be 5, 6 staff from the NDIA. If that person doesn't receive legal aid, and if we weren't there as support, then that individual may well be there on their own. Quite intimidating, I would think. So that would be the process for that conciliation. Can we come to some agreement? Because the NDIA may want to make a decision and say, okay, we'll provide this support. And I'll give you an example. There has been supports gone through where there's supports gone through where they've wanted to conciliate that out so that it really remains with that participant. So if it's conciliated out without going to the actual hearing, that really remains between that client, that participant, and the NDIA. So whatever's agreed with at that point might only be for the 12 months of that plan. 12 months' time, we might have to come back and say, sorry, Kylie, you're not going to get these supports. We still don't think you should get that. And Kylie has to go through this whole process all again. Or they may look at it and say, okay, yeah, we will provide that, but we won't put as many hours in. And again, we might have to go back to challenge their decision. Ultimately, if we get to that conciliation and there's no resolution found, then we have to go to the Administrative Appeal Tribunal hearing, which is the last stage. And that's generally held in Melbourne. And there'll be two members from the Administrative Appeal Tribunal. And they will listen to all the evidence from the participant and from the NDIA. And they have to look at the legislation as well and follow the guidelines of that. And then they will come back with their decision. One of the hearings I was just recently at was 2.5 days of conversation. So it can be quite long. Sometimes it can be one day. But the members are really good. They're really quite friendly. They try and bring down the shock horror of being in this small courtroom. I think they do a really good job at supporting that individual through this process. Within maybe 2 weeks, they'll try and come back with an answer to you, what their decision is. And depending on what that decision is, then the client's going to be really pleased or extremely unhappy, because it will only go two ways. They may come with an agreement that the NDA is correct and that has happened, and it may come back that they will say, we agree with the NDIA, the issue that you've brought to us sits within health. So it's unfortunate for that participant, that person, but at least we now know we've got a clear pathway. NDIA does not fund it, but we need to go to the health system now and put pressure on them. You have to fund it. So it's difficult for that person if that is the decision. And then if we look at Kylie's case, she won that, which is fantastic. She challenged, and they came back and said that this therapy should be provided. So that's a real snapshot that could take 6 months, and we've condensed it into 20 minutes. One thing I want to say, Robin, is what I will say is from seeing Kylie day one and to seeing Kylie today is fantastic. This morning I drove up to Kylie's driveway because I drove in this morning. And Kylie was walking up the driveway, which was just great. Because previously when I went to see Kylie, she was in her house and she couldn't move from the table. Such was the pressures on her body, because they wanted to take away those supports that would help Kylie. And I've seen the difference in Kylie as a person, just being able to walk and do what she wants. Initially, if we go back to that planning process, the NDIA had said, no, we do not want to fund these supports. So they were going to disempower Kylie. They were prepared to put people in Kylie's house to prepare meals and to do house cleaning for her. And Kylie said, that's not what I'm looking for. I want to be independent. I want to do on my own. But they were prepared to put money in for a carer support person, but they weren't prepared to put money in for the therapies. It didn't make sense. And Kylie had the right choice and the right decision to challenge that. And I think she was really brave. Thanks, Robin.
Thanks, James. And Kylie, yes, I think you do need to be commended for... I'm not going to use the word bravery and your inspiration, because we're over that. Those of us with disability are sick of hearing that kind of comment. But I think to have the wherewithal to know what it is that you want and to have the courage of your convictions and to keep plugging away until you got the support that you need, for that I think you need to be commended. And I feel overcome at the moment with a sense of I'm so... oriented to my task orientedness today, that I think I overlooked the true respect that I need to give to you and the kudos that I and we need to give to you, because this whole hour is actually about you, and you are enabling this whole room and everyone who will listen to this presentation or read the transcript. Your story and your tenacity is actually going to aid in the ongoing work of disability advocacy. I think we need to respect that, so thank you. Let's now hear from Len Jaffet, who's the manager of Commonwealth Entitlements at Victoria Legal Aid, and he's going to talk us through, dare I say it, some of the bureaucracy related to this process, a very important part.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Kylie, as well, for two reasons. Kylie's case demonstrates a couple of things.
Oops, is that better? Sorry. I was just thanking Kylie for two reasons. One is it demonstrates the importance of challenging decisions when you feel they're wrong, because often they are wrong and they can be changed. But the other reason is also important. The AAT is not a court, so technically their decisions are not, in a legal sense, precedents. Having said that, other AAT members do have regard to previous decisions that have been made, and decisions made by tribunals do impact on the policies of departments. So I think if this decision had gone the other way, it pretty much would have been a blanket refusal to fund the types of therapies that Kylie was trying to get funded. So this case has certainly ensured that that is not the case. Okay, now I'm going to talk about what I should be talking about. Excuse me. As Robin said, I manage the Commonwealth Entitlements Program at Victoria Legal Aid, which is largely our social security practice, but we also do some work in the NDIS space. We're only a relatively small team, and when the NDIS was introduced, there was no extra resources put in. But a lot of people felt that it's an incredibly important scheme, and it's important to hopefully set it up right from the start. The department itself, I think, was a bit split on this. I think there were some people in the department that wanted to keep lawyers as far away as possible because they were concerned about the scheme becoming more expensive than it might otherwise be. Then I think there were a lot of people in the department at senior levels that accepted it was very important to get some proper basis to the case law from the start so that the scheme was clearer and people had a better sense of what they should be entitled to, and the agency had a better sense as well. And as a consequence, they set up what they call their external merits review scheme. And there's really two components to that. And initially it was only, as I understand it, agreed to do it for, I think, the first 2 or 3 years of the scheme, but at least some of it will continue. So the two components to the EMR support scheme are, one is that every applicant at the Administrative Appeals Tribunal is offered the support of an EMR non-legal support advocate. So in English, that means somebody like James from REAC. That doesn't mean that they can't also have their own support workers or the support workers that they've been dealing with in the past, but they're offered the assistance of somebody that's familiar with the AAT, that's there to support them in a non-legal sense, I guess. As well as that, they decided that they would allocate some funding to pay for legal services. And in each state where the NDIS operates, or territory, that funding's allocated to through the Legal Aid Commission in that state. So it's not for every AAT appeal, and the decisions about who gets funding and who don't are not made by Victoria Legal Aid. They're made by the department, and they're assessed on the basis of whether they determine the case to be novel or complex. The stated reason was to ensure that there was a body of case law early on. To date, so far as I'm aware, pretty much every AAT appeal that's looked like it's going to get anywhere near a hearing has been offered novel or complex funding, because there haven't been all that many decisions, so it's all pretty novel. Over time, that I'd be very surprised if that continues to be the case. And there's also no guarantees that the scheme for the legal funding will operate past the first 2 or 3 years. But at the moment, the scheme is there, and in order for a person to seek funding under that scheme, they can do it themselves. It can be done through their advocates, it can be done through REAC, or a lawyer can apply on their behalf and the department will make a decision about it. If the funding is approved, then the matter is allocated to Victoria Legal Aid and we contact the person and or their worker directly to ensure the person wants to take up the offer of funding. And if we're acting for the person, we will then assist them from that point on in dealing with the preliminary processes and the hearing. So there'll be things like a preliminary conference, a conciliation conference, and ultimately a hearing. It's important to realise that most matters that most appeals lodged to the AAT in the NDIS jurisdiction don't actually proceed to a full hearing. A lot of them are settled without the need for a hearing. That might be because the agency accepts that their original decision was wrong, or it might be some middle ground is reached. But for matters that do go to a hearing, the hearings can be pretty complex and pretty legalistic and probably difficult for a person that's not familiar with the law or not familiar with the AAT. So I guess that also gives rise to the question, what will happen where cases don't attract novel or complex funding? Now, the AAT itself has spent a lot of time and put a lot of effort into setting up a special process for NDIS appeals that has some features that the other appeals at the AAT don't have. They generally get allocated an AAT case officer that will deal with the matter from start to finish. They have a practice direction which is not legally binding but says that they will finalise all appeals within 13 weeks from date of lodgement to a written decision if it goes to a hearing should be done within 13 weeks. And that sounds like a long time, but compared to a lot of other matters at the AAT, trust me, that's not. We have disability support pension appeals that take 6 to 12 or more months, in some other areas even longer. So there's been a lot of goodwill and I think a lot of conscious effort made to try and make the process as usable as possible within the constraints that are there. And I'm not trying to downplay the fact that the AAT, although not a court, is still very technical. It is really an adversarial system, even though they would probably argue it's not. On the other side, there is the agency with its in-house legal team and more resources than probably you or Legal Aid have behind you. So it's not necessarily a level playing field, but at least having an EMR support and a lawyer will make the process a little bit easier. So if a matter does not attract novel or complex funding, it's still possible for a person to make an application direct to Victoria Legal Aid for funding for that legal matter. And to put that in context, a person is really entitled to apply to Legal Aid for funding for any legal matter, whether it's a criminal law matter, a family law matter, a social security matter. That's not to say that every matter will get funded. Victoria Legal Aid allocates funding according to guidelines, and there are different guidelines for different matter types. It also, unlike the novel or complex scheme, has a means test, which is quite restrictive, and has some other tests, including what is loosely called a reasonable self-funded litigant test. So what that means in plain English is, would the person themselves spend their own money on a lawyer if they had the funds? So if, for example, it's a Centrelink dispute over a $500 debt, and we know the legal costs are going to be about $3,000, that sort of matter won't get funding, regardless of anything else. So the point really is that there may be some possibility of funding, even if the matter does not qualify for novel or complex funding, but it would be assessed under Victoria Legal Aid guidelines. The other thing that we do at Legal Aid is we provide services at a range of different levels, if you like. So we have a telephone information service that's open to anybody in the public during business hours 5 days a week, and anybody can ring with any sort of legal query. They will either at that stage be given legal advice directly or they will be referred to an appropriate source if it's something that Legal Aid can't give advice on, or they might be referred to the in-house practice if there's a specialist area. So, for example, all social security inquiries come through to my program. For the NDIS, because our only involvement at this stage really is at the AAT appeal stage, that's after a person's been through the internal review, the anybody ringing with an inquiry about an NDIS appeal at the AAT would be referred through to my section. Anybody ringing about an NDIS matter at other levels would probably be referred either to somewhere like REAC or perhaps back to the agency themselves. So, if I don't know whether you want it now, but the number to ring for any legal aid inquiry is our legal helpline. It's a multilingual service, so they have operators speaking a range of languages. I hope I've got the number right. It's 1300 792 387.
And we'll make sure for the transcript that we double-check that number.
Thank you, that would be wise. The very last thing I'd like to say is just a general tip that I give to everybody that needs to deal with any large organisation, whether it's a private organisation like Telstra or the tax office or Centrelink or the NDIS agency. And I reckon it's a really wise idea to keep your own records. Now, I don't mean you need to write a novel every time you talk to somebody there, keep a diary just with a date, who you spoke to, and just very briefly what advice they gave you, if they gave any advice, what information you gave them, if you gave them any information. And that people say, well, what's the point? Nobody will ever accept that if push comes to shove, if they haven't got their records. Having worked on a tribunal in a previous life, where people do keep those sorts of records, they do carry a lot of weight, because most people accept that department's records are not necessarily 100% complete or accurate. They're a starting point, and that's all. Thank you.
Thanks, Len. That's really good advice. So, Kylie has gone through the participant application process. She's had a plan, or attempted to have a plan. She's requested that there be a review of the decision that the NDIA made, and it's gone through an internal review process within the NDIA. She hasn't been happy with that, so she's contacted an advocacy organisation. She's been allocated to, or James has been allocated to her case, and he's taken her through the external merits review support process. They've applied for funding. I've forgotten again what CAP stands for, Len and James. It's on your flowcharts, on your table.
It stands for novel or complex.
Central Assessment.
Thank you.
Central Assessment Provider Funding. The case has been allocated that funding. It goes back to Victorian Legal Aid, where the case is then allocated through their processes to a lawyer. Enter Rosalinda Casamento.
Thank you. I'm just going to talk to you in a little bit more detail about Kylie's case and the work we did with Kylie to get to the result that we got. When Kylie's case first came to me, I think it was actually at the point where she had already participated in the first process at the AAT. Len talked about how quickly these matters are dealt with once they reach the AAT. The applicant is usually contacted within 3 days of the application being lodged, and from there it really is quite a swift process through all the steps to a hearing if the matter does eventuate in a hearing. So I think in Kylie's case, either Lance or James may have attended the first case conference with Kylie. At that first conference, James has already explained, there's a discussion about the issues in the case. And in Kylie's case, the central question was whether the chiropractic treatment that she and other physical therapy that she had been receiving under her ISP would be funded by the NDIA as a reasonable and necessary support. I think in Kylie's very first plan, the NDIA were prepared to fund only 3 chiropractic sessions to allow her to transition into this new arrangement, and as Kylie said, thereafter she would be expected to fund that treatment herself. So the case essentially revolved around whether chiropractic, and I'm James referred to sections and subsections of the legislation, so I'm just going to read you out the relevant one of the relevant subsections that we needed to argue in Kylie's case to satisfy the tribunal that chiropractic was a reasonable and necessary support in Kylie's case. So the section is, in relation to whether chiropractic was a reasonable and necessary support, the support will be, or is likely to be, effective and beneficial for the participant, having regard to current good practice. Now, there are also rules which explain in more detail what effective and beneficial and current good practice mean, or what the NDIA can have regard to when they come to make a decision about whether a support will be funded because it's effective and beneficial having regard to current good practice. And the rules say that the evidence that the NDIA may refer to include published and refereed literature and the consensus of any expert opinion. So that's one thing that the NDIA can have regard to. And another thing was the lived experience of the participant and their carers. So when I got the T documents, James also referred to the T documents. When I got the T documents in relation to Kylie's case, they were in a big lever arch folder. And the material almost exclusively comprised many, many articles that had been accessed by the agency in relation to chiropractic. And overwhelmingly, those articles concluded that chiropractic was not a treatment that that gave really any benefit in relation to certain types of conditions. So, for example, chronic low back pain, and there were other conditions. So the NDIA, in reviewing Kylie's case at the internal review stage, had really only honed in on that part of the test which suggests that you can refer to published literature. They hadn't considered at all the lived experience of the participant. So when I got allocated Kylie's case, one of the things that jumped out at me straight away was that Kylie had been on an ISP for a number of years, and she had been receiving chiropractic treatment under that ISP for a number of years. And even prior to that, I think you've been accessing it in the community. So she had a long history of accessing this particular type of treatment. So our approach in Kylie's case at a very, very early stage was to say to the NDIA, hey, what about lived experience? And I recall having a couple of very long conversations with Kylie about her lived experience in relation to how chiropractic was actually maintaining her function and enabling her to do things, as she said, working, and then looking after her daughter. And she'd been able to maintain a level of function that she was happy with having accessed this treatment. So we prepared, as I say, at an early stage in the case, quite a long, I guess you would call it a witness statement, because we were at this level of review, outlining to the NDIA why we said that Kylie's chiropractic treatment met one of the considerations in relation to lived experience, and that this should be given weight in terms of the NDIA's decision about whether chiropractic was effective and beneficial for Kylie. And we asked the NDIA if they would consider that particular aspect of Kylie's case And we were hoping for an early settlement based on the evidence in relation to lived experience. Now, that didn't happen. The reason why it didn't happen became apparent as we progressed, and particularly became apparent during the hearing. At one point in the hearing, the tribunal member asked the lawyers for the NDIA, "Are you asking me to make a decision that chiropractic can never be a reasonable and necessary support in this context?" So any participant who was seeking to have funded chiropractic as part of their plan would always be knocked back. And the lawyers indicated that that was the that was the decision that they were looking for. So the reason it appeared that we weren't able to settle Kylie's case early on the basis of this really persuasive evidence in relation to lived experience was because the NDIA had obtained research or had asked internally some employees to conduct some research in relation to chiropractic. They'd come up with this big body of evidence which suggested that chiropractic was not the kind of treatment which was effective and beneficial, to use those terms. So the case we ran in relation to the reasonable and necessary support aspect, two limbs. The first limb was that, in fact, the published and refereed literature put before the tribunal in relation to chiropractic was not reliable. And the other limb was the lived experience, Kylie's lived experience. The NDIA, in the course of running the matter, sought a report from an expert who, and I've forgotten her area of practice, but she practices, I think, in the area with people with... TAC, that's right. But she had some experience in dealing with people with I think neurological conditions actually arising out of these types of injuries. So a report was commissioned for this expert to do another literature review to provide expert evidence to the tribunal in relation to this question of effective and beneficial having regard to published and refereed literature. There were problems with that because the NDIA gave the expert only a limited amount of time to do that research, and when the report came in, it was quite clear that it was much less than a comprehensive review of the available literature, and that the conclusions couldn't be categoric in relation to chiropractic in all cases not being beneficial. When we cross-examined her, she was quite willing to say that when it comes to looking at these types of treatments, you really do have to look at the individual, at whether the treatment is effective for that individual. Is the treatment maintaining that individual's function or whatever, the treatment is aimed to do? So that for us, that was a significant concession. We had also done our own literature review and been able to locate a couple of articles which we relied on to suggest that there was published literature out there which contradicted what the NDIA had been able to put before the tribunal. So in its decision, the AAT, the tribunal, was very careful to confine its findings to the facts of Kylie's case. So the member was at pains to talk about the evidence of Kylie's treaters, about the effectiveness of particular types of chiropractic treatment for Kylie. Also, said, if I might just read you a bit of what the tribunal said in relation to the literature, just because it can be overwhelming for you to be presented, I guess, with a bundle of documents like this, with medical reports that look as though, you know, they provide a complete answer to whatever it is, whatever treatment it is that you might be seeking in your plan. We have had other clients at VLA who've sought massage therapy as a treatment, and we had a similar issue in relation to whether massage therapy would be accepted in particular plans as well, again presented with quite a large bundle of medical research in relation to the efficacy for that condition. So the tribunal said that the expert acknowledged that there is a limited role that literature can play in determining most effective treatment in an individual case. So there are a number of studies suggesting positive outcomes, as well as the studies which suggested less than positive outcomes. And then the tribunal said, in these circumstances, Ms. McCutcheon's lived experience is especially relevant. And McCutcheon is the first case that actually considers lived experience and talks about the weight that the tribunal will give lived experience in the context of all of the evidence. So the tribunal needs to weigh up what a participant in any case says about the efficacy of particular treatments that they have against... against what the evidence of her chiropractor might be or her physiotherapist might be, and also against what the literature says. So, for example, if Kylie was saying something wildly at odds with what the literature said and wildly at odds with what her own treatise was saying, her evidence in relation to lived experience obviously wouldn't be given much weight. But the tribunal in Kylie's case... felt that her evidence need to be given very considerable weight. So, it was a very pleasing outcome.
It was a fantastic outcome. Well done. We'll cut you off there, but I'm sure you'll have an opportunity to answer some questions, Rosalinda. Sophie, I understand you're happy to be microphone runner again. It's question time. Please raise your hands if you have a question. And if you're comfortable, please say your name and who, what organisation you represent. Trudy, I might give you first option for a question if you do have one, Trudy Ryle. And also anyone who had their hand up at the last session but didn't get to ask their question, you have first dibs this session. Can you somehow indicate to Sophie who you are? And do and can, Sophie, can you just let me know how many hands we have raised? We don't have any questions? Oh, okay, fabulous. Fabulous, okay.
It's George from the Youth Disability Advocacy Service. Thanks, Carly. Can I ask, in terms of getting your ISP to fund chiropractic, was there a battle there? So that's one question. And my next question is, what about the fact that you suffered quite a bit of pain and distress as a result of this? Were you able to claim any compensation as a result of what NDIA put you through?
I don't know. I didn't try. That would be the answer for that. As for my ISP, so I had like chiropractic and physiotherapy funded under a Medicare program, and then that program was closed down. So at that point, it was requested under my ISP for funding for that, and after a long process of medical records and medical people, you know, basically saying that it's an appropriate treatment for my condition, the ISP did fund, yeah.
So you've been there before in terms of that battle?
Yeah, I've been there before. Okay, it was a lesser battle the first time.
Jax, I guess that's part of my question as well. Were you able to argue for loss of income and emotional distress and physical distress? And did they pay or allow you to have more funding to get your body back up to the point that it was before they discontinued your treatment?
So, yes, at the moment I'm undergoing quite intensive physiotherapy and chiropractic treatment to get back as much as my body will give us. Mm-hmm. And, yes, as I said before, I haven't really contemplated pain and suffering litigation.
Mm. And just...
Question without notice.
Sure. Look, I guess the short answer is I don't think there's any direct way of claiming it through the NDIS. It's an administrative decision that was made and was subsequently overturned, and a similar thing happens in other jurisdictions. In, say, Centrelink people have a long battle to get put on the DSP, for example. There is... I guess... in theory, you can go back to common law negligence, but I'm not suggesting anybody try it because, firstly, it's a court and there's court costs involved and cost implications, and you would need to establish a whole range of things, including... pretty much bad faith in the initial decision maker. Having said that, there is another Commonwealth scheme that's got nothing directly to do with the NDIA, and my knowledge really comes from Centrelink matters, but there's a scheme under finance law called compensation for detriment due to defective administration, and that allows people that who believe that they have suffered defective administration and as a consequence suffered some sort of detriment, usually financial detriment, but theoretically it could be broader, to put in a claim for a payment under that scheme. And I don't know about the agency, but I know with other organisations or departments, so for example, Centrelink has a delegation to make payments under that scheme up to a certain amount. The difficulty with that scheme is, firstly, it's difficult to establish all the elements. Not impossible, but it can be difficult. Secondly, if you're unsuccessful, there's no statutory review and appeal rights as there are with NDIS decisions or Centrelink decisions. I guess in theory you might be able to go to the federal court, but again, I wouldn't encourage anybody to do that. It would be a hugely expensive process and possibly problematic. So just to give you an example of the sorts of things that scheme might cover in a slightly different context, supposing we're talking about a Centrelink payment, say age pension. Supposing I'm old enough to get the age pension, I'm 65 years of age and I go into Centrelink and I say I want to claim the age pension, here's my birth certificate, and the person on the counter isn't very good at arithmetic, take one look at that and say, no, you're too young, come back in 3 years. And I just accept that and go off. And a year later, I'm at my doctor's and he asks me for my pension card and I say, well, they've told me I don't even get one for another 2 years, and he says, that can't be right. Long story short, I go back to Centrelink and it turns out that first information was clearly wrong. So I do lodge the claim for age pension, but I won't get it backdated. I'll only get it from the date I made the claim. Because that's the way Social Security law works. You need to put in a claim to set a date. I would probably have a claim there under the CDDA scheme to say that that initial advice I got was defective. Clearly people rely on Centrelink to give advice about that sort of thing all the time and they should be giving correct advice. And I could clearly establish that 12 months worth of age pension was a direct detriment or loss as a direct consequence of that defective administration. So that's sort of like a clearer example. So I'm not saying don't try it under... If anything happens at the NDIA that causes you some sort of detriment, I'm just saying that I'm just trying to be realistic about the prospects. But I'd certainly encourage people that feel that they have suffered defective administration from any Commonwealth government body or agency
to put in an application for a payment under that scheme. The other thing they can do is make a complaint to the Commonwealth Ombudsman's Office, who doesn't have any direct decision-making powers but does have a lot of powers around investigation and ultimately powers to table reports in Parliament. And occasionally they do assist people with CWDA claims. I hope that's kind of answered the question, even though I dodged the most important bit because I don't know the answer to that.
Sorry, just flowing on from that, so if somebody wanted to make a claim under that defective administration scheme, say in that aged pension case that you gave, who would you... Would you go to Centrelink?
Sure.
How would you do it?
Yeah, look, in the first instance, you would make the application to Centrelink. They've probably got a claim form you can use, but there's no formalities. You can do it just in a letter-headed claim for compensation for detriment. It's technically authorised under... regulations from the Department of, I think it's called Finance and Deregulation now, which is just a bizarre name for anything. But so there'll be information on that department's website as well, and there'll be information on Centrelink's website. The Commonwealth Ombudsman's Office from time to time does what they call own motion reviews, and I think they've done a review into that scheme sometime in the last 5 years or so. So there'll be information on their website as well.
I just had another... quick little question. So if you'd lost, would have you been liable for all their costs?
I'm happy to answer that question. The Administrative Appeals Tribunal is what we call a no-cost jurisdiction. So there is no capacity for the tribunal to award legal costs to one side or the other. So the standard position in a court... is that the losing party gets ordered to pay the successful party's legal costs at a sort of scale rate. That does not apply in tribunals. There is, you're only liable for your own legal costs to your own lawyers.
Okay. And will you have to fight this every time you get a review, or is this a lifelong thing they will now fund?
I believe it's as long as necessary.
Okay, thank God.
Yeah, look.
Do we have any more questions?
Yeah, if I can, please.
Sorry, just on that last point, the way the process works is that, you know, there are, once the NDIA makes a decision, a reviewable decision, you can go and have that decision internally reviewed and taken to the AET. So it really focuses on the decision. So the next decision about Kylie's case is not, strictly speaking, limited by a previous decision. However, if there's no significant changes in circumstances one way or the other, one would like to think that whoever's making the new decision would give serious consideration to previous decisions. It's probably the best way I can answer that.
Thanks, Ben. Our next question?
So maybe for James, I suspect... Just you say that you've managed to actually resolve a lot of matters before, you know, at the point initially of lodging the request or, you know, review internally. I just wondered sort of what proportion. And then I wondered, in regard to the circumstance that we've seen where a person's been substantially disadvantaged, is there any thought or have you encountered any willingness in NDIA to... look at continuation of supports pending an actual review process?
Yeah, thanks for the question. The first point, I think to answer it without giving you a real number percentage-wise, I would probably say since NDIA opened, I have had, I think, probably 160, 170 cases solely with the NDIA. That's not including anything else that might pop up as an issue. Most of them, I would say, have been able to have some type of resolution prior to going for that review of a reviewable decision. So what's came back out of the review process, I think we're probably on about 22, 23 cases that's went to the AAT. Just now, I've got 8 cases that's open, proceeding with the AAT. So I think the percentages are really high that we've been able to get those resolutions within the NDIA setting. One in particular, and it's around transport costs. There's a lot of issues about the transport costs just now where they're saying that the participant should pay a contribution the same as the NDIA pay a contribution towards travel costs. So they're not going to pay 100% if it goes over the threshold of the 3 stages of the funding that they've put forward for transport. One client put forward a review, and the delegate came out, had a conversation with that person to really understand a little bit more about them, their situation, where they're at, location-wise. And they had a conversation. They went away, the delegate went away, and they'd done some more research and review, and they came back to the client and said, I've managed to give this review some thought after having this conversation with yourself, and I feel that I can give you X amount of dollars to your transport until this plan ceases. So it could have been $200-$300. I can't remember how much it was, but that money was put towards the plan for the next 12 months. So that was really conciliated out without having to go anywhere else other than have that conversation. So it was really good to see that we could do that. In saying that, the client was pleased with that because they'd actually been to the AAT prior. So they were kind of over it. They'd had enough. So they were quite pleased to get that conciliation at that point. So that plan will probably be reviewed quite thoroughly by that participant within the next 12 months, because when their new plan comes out, the funding level they've got just now, they won't receive that. So we'll have to go through that whole process again, unless that client changes their goals. Depending on where they want to travel to, they may change that. There might be supports or services closer to them. So there's quite a lot involved to try and get that sort of fine resolution between NDIA and the participant. Has that answered your question?
Yep. We need to finish. Is there anyone who...
I've got the mic.
We're going well into afternoon tea time, so 2 more questions and then we'll finish.
Pauline Williams from AMIDA. My question is about whether the NDIA is kind of learning from and responding to the reviews, including the external reviews, in the way in which they plan for people, and whether they're still ruling things out that on review they've decided they will or been told they will include. Are they? I know that precedent isn't set, but are they actually changing the way in which they look at planning and what is in and what isn't in?
Try and answer a little bit of that question. I know that they closely monitor the decisions of the AAT, and certainly a year ago, which was the last time I went to kind of a meeting of the National Legal Aids and the people that provide the novel and complex funding, at that stage there had been at least a couple that have fed very quickly back into their internal policy documents. Mm-hmm. So they've changed their policy favourably as a direct consequence of AAT decisions. And they said that that was an undertaking that they were giving, that they were going to take on board those findings of the AAT quite quickly. As I said earlier, the other jurisdiction I work a lot in is the Centrelink jurisdiction at the AAT. And they also keep a very close eye on the AAT decisions, but in my experience are not nearly as responsive and are more likely to try and change the law than change their policies. I hope this is... this probably is being recorded. If anybody knows a job that I can do next week, that would be good.
Okay, our final question.
Yeah, Tricky Chaplin here. I guess thinking about the examples that were given this morning about, and they were fairly clear-cut black and white examples of what wouldn't be funded and why. Kylie's case study or scenario seems to point out that there are, you know, many instances where it's not so black and white as to who should fund particular therapies or, you know, interventions and why. I just wonder, you know, whether people feel that the NDIA are kind of reaching these decisions without necessarily taking into account lived experience and reviewing things from absolutely every angle. Reasonable and necessary has always been a word, you know, or a phrase that I think's been very dangerous and can be very open to manipulation. And, I just wonder about the tendency of the NDIA to be, you know, giving these decisions a bit of short shrift, if you like.
I guess in relation to Kylie's case, the thing that leapt out was that they appeared to have, in conducting the research, taken an insurance approach to the question. And you do need to take into account, as part of the NDIA scheme, that there is issues around the ensuring the financial sustainability of the NDIS. So, for example, the 2011 Productivity Commission report stated that it would be important for the NDIS not to respond to funding shortfalls in mainstream health services by providing its own substitute services. So I think that concept of financial sustainability is certainly feeding into those types of decisions about reasonable and necessary supports, and it is something that the tribunal is very conscious of, and the tribunal in its decisions you will find certainly references the issue of financial sustainability. So I guess to answer your question, that is a consideration that we suspect is driving a lot of these decisions, but it is not the only consideration, and that was, you know, very clearly apparent in the McCutcheon decision.
Thank you, Rosalinda. Team Kylie, thank you very much for this fabulous presentation this afternoon. We'll have a very short afternoon tea break just to give everybody a stretch break and a chance to relieve yourselves. I just wanted to point out, we have on the PowerPoint, on the slide behind me, we're demonstrating the page on the DARU resource around the Advocacy Sector Conversations Forum. We've put together a whole lot of resources for you arising out of today's forum. It's live on our website now. The link will be available to you, as I've mentioned earlier today. But Rosalinda wrote up the case notes for Kylie's case, and it's a really good case review. We've also provided a link to the full case write-up of the Administrative Appeals Tribunal findings, accessed via the Ausley link, and a few other resources. So there's lots to follow on from here today. And can I urge you that you do make yourself, acquaint yourself with these resources and pass them on to your boards, your managers, your team, the people who you're advocating for, because they're really, really good information sources specifically to what we've been talking about today.